I will now pass it over to Jennifer Hanna, who will open today's call.
Thank you, Megan, and good afternoon, everyone. I am Jennifer Hanna, the director of the ASPR's Office of Healthcare Readiness. Before I hand it over to our first presenter, I would like to provide a brief overview of what we will cover today. Next slide, please. Today's meeting will focus on the intersection of healthcare, health equity, and climate change, and we have some great speakers lined up for you today. First, I will begin by providing a few updates relating to ASPR's healthcare readiness programs. Then Kristen Finney, the director of the HHS Empower program, will provide an overview of the Empower program. Next, Commander Roberto Garza, acting director for the Division of Recovery Operations within ASPR's Office of Community Mitigation and Recovery, will present on the office's efforts to support equitable recovery in communities impacted by disasters. Afterwards, Joe McKinnon, a senior advisor for the HHS Office of Climate Change and Health Equity, will discuss the intersection of healthcare, health equity, and climate change, and what the office is currently doing in that realm. Finally, we will leave some time at the end for general questions from the audience. Next slide, please. So I'd like to start today's webinar with a few updates on ASPR's healthcare readiness programs. Next slide, please. As you might remember, last time we met, we discussed ASPR's updated organizational structure. Under the updated organizational structure, the National Healthcare Preparedness Programs was elevated from a branch to an office and renamed the Office of Healthcare Readiness. This is an exciting elevation within ASPR's organizational structure and is a result of the growing emphasis on the importance of healthcare readiness. We've heard concerns that HPP, or the Hospital Preparedness Program, or other programs may be going away with this new organizational structure. This is definitely not the case. In fact, our name change and elevation to an office results in more attention and focus on our programs. And we think that this is really a great thing. On the screen, you can see the ASPR's new org chart to the left. And on the right, you see the Office of Healthcare Readiness in more detail. We've broken down our major capabilities as well as our programs and activities. And as you can see, there have been no major changes to our programs and activities. Rest assured, our partners will continue to be our priority, and we look forward to growing our partnerships with all of you. Next slide, please. As many of you know as well, HHS ASPR is currently updating the healthcare preparedness and response capabilities to reflect insights learned from recent disasters. And now we are at the point where we are soliciting your feedback and input as a part of our pre-decisional review. We know many of you participated in discussions leading up to the development of the pre-decisional draft, and now we welcome your review and feedback. In addition, we know that many may have participated in some of the informational sessions that we conducted related to the pre-decisional draft review. We are accepting comments until Friday, June 9th. You can view the pre-decisional review draft and access the online comment matrix to submit your comments using the links we will share in the chat. We are looking for comments on proposed changes on the following. If there is a missing element in the document that is critical to saving lives and ensuring healthcare continues to function, if there is something in the document that is factually incorrect and needs to be removed or updated, and then finally, if you have a proposed additional link to a publicly available resource to support implementation of any of the listed activities. We have also developed frequently asked questions that provide additional background and clarifications on both the document and this pre-decisional review process. Next slide, please. As a reminder, The updated capabilities provide more specificity around what the entire healthcare delivery system can do to save lives and to continue to function in advance of, during, and after a response. The updated capabilities also prioritize equity in all activities, with the goal of ensuring access to consistent levels of care in underserved and historically marginalized communities and at-risk individuals. Thank you in advance for your ongoing engagement to ensure the capabilities are relevant and applicable to healthcare and emergency response partners. I will now pass it over to Kristen Finney to provide an overview of the HHS Empower program. Kristen?
Thanks, Jennifer. All right. Okay, next slide. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm the director of the HHS Empower program. I'm here to give you a brief overview about this program and resource tools and informational platforms that we've developed for you and some recent changes to the program that can hopefully help your work as you go forward in addressing the needs of at-risk community members in your localities. The HHS Empower program has been in existence for now a decade. It's hard to believe. We came into fruition in 2013 in response to advances in technology that were leveraging the ability for individuals, that, and particularly those that have chronic illnesses and disabilities, to live independently in their community. And also the advances of healthcare service delivery into community-based and home-based models of care as well. And while these individuals do okay daily, the challenges that we've seen progressively starting in prior to and following Hurricane Sandy is that these individuals get quickly disconnected from their healthcare services, such as dialysis and oxygen tank services that are delivered to their home, as well as those that rely on certain types of life-maintaining and assistive equipment, such as ventilators, concentrators, and such. And those individuals rapidly get thrust into life-threatening situations. Many of them rapidly overwhelm 911, go to emergency departments, overwhelm EMS, and also shelters too. So what we did was we partnered with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, particularly the Medicare program. That's a federal health insurance program. And what we did was we actually mined their data, and we do this on a monthly basis to understand the total number of Medicare beneficiaries that currently have claims for four types of healthcare services, as well as also 14 different types of life-maintaining and assistive equipment, and also device, cardiac implantable devices. In order to make sure that we were protecting those individuals and understanding the needs of those individuals, what we did was we translated them. We wanted to make sure that we had readily meaningful, consumable, and actionable data. And we wanted to translate them into the right data, right tool, right person, and right time. Based on the levels of responsibility and the roles that people have, whether they're just a community participant that wants to help out, volunteer, all the way up to an official or a partner at the local public health, the state public health, that are going to basically doing more detailed scenario planning. What we have is developed over this past decade is a suite of tools. Publicly available is the HHS Empower map. You can go to that map. You can actually see the total number of electricity dependent, as well as also different new at-risk combinations that we just rolled out recently. We also have, for those that have their own GIS application, we don't want you to have to go to our map, but instead take that data, add it as a data layer in your own map, and be able to use it with your other data layers. And we'll talk a little bit more about that because we just changed that URL and we're going to have you re-sign up for that. And then we also created Empower AI, which we, for those that need voice activated and want to use an Amazon Alexa skill or Google Virtual Assistant for responders that were having trouble with some of the internet connectivity, we've created that capability that you can ask it and it can tell you the answers from the Empower map for you. For those that are at the state public health and also local public health authorities and healthcare coalitions, we produce also a monthly, more expanded, detailed, de-identified, meaning we protect all privacy information, none of it's in there, that emergency planning data set that actually goes out, and you can use that for more detailed scenario planning and activities. And that data set can be shared with anybody who's working on emergency preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation activities in their communities and planning and such, and also in response. And then in the event of an imminent or current disaster, only statutorily authorized public health authorities at the state and in limited cases at a county level, those public health authorities that meet HIPAA requirements can request an individual level data set to support life-saving outreach or activities that in case that it's the break glass capability that we have. Now, also important to note is that we have online training that's available through the Train website. And it's all of this information, detailed job aids and resources and informational fact sheets, everything from stories from the field, an interactive map of how it's being used to reflect the great work of individuals across the state country. We have created and we rolled out during during 2021, basically at the same time as the COVID vaccination campaign started, we rolled out the HHS Empower Program platform. It's a website. It's readily accessible. You can actually go to it. You can find detailed job aids and resources so that you can have it in a just-in-time and be able to use all these tools. That was something that everybody had requested, and we put that out into play, and we were able to roll it out. Unfortunately, fairly enough, it wasn't as heard given the COVID response, and we understand that. So we just want to bring that out. Next slide. So just for a quick snapshot, the total number of Medicare beneficiaries that are included in this population are 4.3 million. And it's also important when we're talking about equity, is about 32% of them are what's called dual eligible. They're enrolled and also eligible into a state Medicaid program, which indicates that due to their chronic condition, their disability, or their socioeconomic status, that they qualify for that program in addition to their Medicare program. Those individuals are commonly understood and known to be high risk. So we do get a snapshot. While we don't have all Medicaid, we do have a pretty good snapshot of the highest risk in that group. This includes 14 different types of equipment. It also includes healthcare services that include oxygen tank, a dialysis in a facility, home health services, and at-home hospices services as well. Next slide. Most recently, what I talked about is that we've actually made some updates. Based on feedback from healthcare coalitions and hospital executives through numerous different disasters, many had asked about our ability to bring out that healthcare service data that we haven't been able to publish publicly yet, based on different CMS requirements for bidding and such. So what we were able to do in response to requests was many said we would like to know permutations of those that are electricity dependent and also healthcare dependent. So what we have created is 5 new data categories, which is an individual who's on dialysis who also has dependencies on DME, the same thing for oxygen tank and DME, home health, DME, at-home hospice. And then we also provide for any individual that could have one or more healthcare services and also DME, so that we were not double counting those individuals and you know exactly what the number is. Next slide. Also important to note is that the HHS Empower REST service has changed. We've gone to the cloud. Our partners at GeoHealth have transitioned and are in the process of flipping over their systems. So this REST service is now alive. The old one is going to be turned off. So we do encourage you, please, very soon and quickly, click on that link. We have a job aid ready and readily available to you that can tell you literally how to do it in a matter of a minute. It takes 3 clicks and you're done. So that way you can continue to get all of this great data into your own GIS applications. Next slide. So how Empower has helped, whether it's from the public map all the way up to individual outreach and disasters. Over these past years, we've had an incredible litany of different types of disasters that have impacted localities across our nation and in our territories. And this data has actually been able to help in a host of different ways, whether it's from preparedness planning of looking at what should we have in our medical caches and are we including the types of equipment that might be highest risk and need, all the way to, are we able to deploy out and help leverage with our urban search and rescues as we're going through those communities to also identify areas that might have higher risk of electricity dependent individuals with DME and or oxygen tank services, such as in Tennessee, they looked to do that outreach in the Gatlinburg wildfire years back. We've also used it in severe, winter storms in rural areas of Wyoming, where they actually use this data in a rural area because cooperatives were going down after multiple blizzards and they did outreach to those individuals that are electricity oxygen dependent. We actually also have supported at the federal level, myself included, I went through the whole process in support of the US Virgin Islands, and we used this data to also support dialysis evacuations for individuals after their healthcare was destroyed, both from dialysis facilities to their hospitals on the island of St. Thomas and later also issues in St. Croix. So there's been a whole scale of ways in which this data has supported, and we continue to monitor and learn. We do want to encourage anybody who's used this data and has great stories to tell us, please send it to us at empower@hhs.gov. We welcome the opportunity. We're happy to have a conversation with you. Everything you provide is also vetted with you, but we want to do feature the great work that you guys are doing nationwide. Next slide. As we're talking about climate change and resources and information, Empower has also had the opportunity to participate in the Million Hearts Climate Change and Cardiovascular Disease Collaborative webinar. There's a host of numbers of different webinars talking about the interface between health, in particular for cardiovascular disease, and impacts of extreme heat and other climate change factors. I encourage you to check out them. They're great tools and resources, and they're really great to share with your state and local and other community partners too. They're greatly informative, and they explain the different factors and how there's tools and resources available. The same thing goes for the National Integrated Health Heat Health Information Systems. They had a national meeting, but they also have a website, and I encourage you to check out that website. It talks about all the different factors about heat, and I'm sure more will be discussed later. Next slide. And just a parting memory and note, please encourage you to go and check out the HHS Empower Program platform. This was created for all of you in response to your request, and it took us a while to get there, but we finally got the funding and we were able to roll it out in January 21. So this information has readily accessible information. It has job aids and fact sheets that you can readily use. And also it has an Empower in Action tab that actually gives an interactive map, and it has detailed stories from the field that actually tell you how it was applied, partners that used it in concert with public health, and the actions and lessons learned that they did. Additionally, we have online trainings. One most recently added was for DME and also reconnecting individuals that are electricity or other DME dependent from Medicare beneficiaries and how to do that in a disaster. I encourage you to check out the training tab and you'll see really great online training. It's free, as well as job aids that you can hand out in shelters for responders as well as for beneficiaries as well too. Next slide. And here's just a sample of that interactive map that you can check out. Next slide. And also just a sampling of the fact sheets and detailed job aids, so you have a reference to those as well. Thanks so much. Next slide. Here's our resources, and we're able to be readily accessible. As I noted before, we have an email that you can contact us with any questions. It's empower@hhs.gov. And I'm happy to also take any quick questions if we have a few minutes left.
Thank you, Kristen. And we do, we are opening up the call for anyone that may have questions. And just as a reminder, you can enter those questions into the to the chat, or you can raise your hand and answer your question, ask your question live, not answer your own question, but you can ask your question live as well. Kristen, would you mind restating how often the data is refreshed for the Empower Map, please?
Absolutely. It's updated on a monthly basis. It's pretty a seamless process. And what you'll wind up finding is that it's usually updated about the second week, late in the second week of each month, when we also push out those de-identified data sets as well. Absolutely. I'm happy to share our slides and make sure you're able to provide it to your coalition partners.
Kristen, are there any things that are coming that are around the corner? Or you can speak to, not necessarily on the slide, about the future of Empower. I mean, although you've done some great work and had some great development, especially of some new tools and resources that are available. I mean, it's incredible to see how it has grown. from just literally just a map on a page to have expanded or rather to explode it. But certainly if there's any updates or things that are coming.
So one of the other things that we did, just for time, I didn't include this, is that starting in 2018, we were a little bit slowed down by COVID, but we offered to state public health authorities and their state counterpart Medicaid agencies that wanted to participate. We actually have a free voluntary pilot that is helping state Medicaid agencies actually generate that Medicaid and child health insurance data that is available, most timely available in the state operated systems, because unfortunately at the federal level, we just not quite there yet. We're getting there, but we're not quite there. You're the best timely information that you can rely on that we have with Medicare. What we did was we actually launched a program. So where we couldn't do it for you, what we wanted to do was teach you how to do it. So what we have actually come up with is detailed instructions and capabilities to actually explain to the Medicaid side of the house how to actually replicate the Empower algorithms, the libraries, and the templates to be able to self-generate, mining their own state-operated Medicaid and child health insurance data to create those complementary data sets within their own state. That data then in turn can actually be used to help provide also information. Not only we provide older adults clearly for Medicare and those that are disabled and qualify in, how about that Medicaid data provides more information on other disabled adults that we don't capture with Medicare, but also pediatric patients, which I think is really critical for preparing and responding to the needs in their communities. So we've had a number of different states that have participated and have completed it. North Carolina has completed it. Also, more recently, Oregon has, and they most recently have used this data in number of their wildfire responses when they had catastrophic wildfires at a historic level, sadly in 2020 and in more recent years as well. So this provided not only from the federal data program what we provide, Medicare, but also them having their complementary state Medicaid and child health insurance program data. They had a more complete, more understanding of the ages and brackets of those that are high risk and such. So I encourage people to check that out. There's more information about that on our website. And also we are looking to see other partners that might be interested in this. Our hope is in the future that we are going to see in the future, we might be able to expand Empower to do this when the federal data is also more timely and accurate and we're able to build that in. So that's one of the things I have on my, you know, future look. And also looking and expanding this to other types of at-risk populations and where we might be able to partner with other agencies across the federal government to bring in more information to be able to provide that for you. So that way you have a one-stop shop and or you have ways in which to get other different types of information and such. And we've also been doing a lot of work with Census too to help them expand on how they can operationalize their data a little bit too, the great data that they get for the census. So lots more to come and we just keep treading along. So thanks, Jennifer.
No, thanks for that, Kristen. And it looks like someone else is singing your praises here. Says that Empower is awesome. And there is a note here about Empower taking over the collecting provider level EEI data during disasters. Kidding, just kind of sort of. But continue doing the great work that you are doing, Kristen. Thank you. So again, of course, thank you to Kristen for taking the time to be with us today. I will now pass it over to Commander Roberto Garza to provide an overview of the Office of Community Mitigation and Recovery and their equitable recovery efforts. Commander Garza.
Good afternoon. I wanted to make sure I'm coming in well, and maybe you're seeing me.
We can see you and we can hear you.
Awesome. It's a great privilege to be on this call and also to come after Kristen Finney. We used to work under the same office before the Asperger's reorganization, so I miss you, Kristen. I did want to start by saying something real quick. I don't know if you can hear this. I live in the city of Annapolis, Maryland, which is home to the Naval Academy, as many of you know. And today, this week is what's called Commissioning Week, which is a week where the fourth year midshipman from the Naval Academy graduate, and right now is the Blue Angel flyover. So every 2 minutes, you might hear a because the jets are like right above me. It's very special. So thank you again for this opportunity. I'd love to talk about recovery. If we can go to the next slide, because I'd love to share sort of what we do in ASPR and in the federal government. So the way to maybe paint the contrast is that recovery is something, so there's the National Response Framework, the NRF, and then the NDRF, Disaster Recovery Framework. The response framework has been around for significantly longer than the NDRF. The response framework has been around, I believe, mid-90s. So it's a very established function. So you have the 15 ESFs, and many of you are aware that ASPR and HHS lead the Public Health and Medical ESF 8. So the NDRF is a little bit younger than that, but we've exhibited quite a bit of growth in the last few years. The key bullet in this slide here is that the framework and our operational doctrine is that recovery is locally, federally supported, but it's locally, there's primacy at the state, at the sort of the sovereign level, be it state, tribe, or territory government. So we're there at the invitation of the state, tribe, or territory government, and we're there to support where there are unmet recovery needs. Next slide, please. There are, as opposed to this 15 ESFs, the emergency support functions, there's only 6 RSFs, so they're combined a little different. Ours is the Health and Social Services, that fourth one from left to right, Health and Social Services Recovery Support Function. It's coordinated, and if you can go to the next slide, you'll see sort of the listing of the coordinating agency. So it's coordinating by HHS, but specifically it's coordinating by the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response within our office. So I'm the acting director for recovery operations, but under the Office of Community Mitigation and Recovery. But so these are what we call the sort of the coordinating agency. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see that we have quite a bit of primary, what we call primary agencies. Absolutely, we want to support health and social services recovery, but our role here is to sort of work collaboratively with not only the operational divisions within HHS, sort of the CDC and the SAMHSA, the HRSA, the CMS, but also we have quite great partnership, particularly these days with Department of Education and other departments on recovery. Next slide, please. So if you can, I think this is the slide where you click, if you can do one click for me, yep. So as I was saying earlier, recovery has experienced quite a bit of growth in terms of our activations. Thus far, and if this fiscal year, ASPR, we've experienced a 300% increase in the number of presidentially declared disasters for which our RSF has been activated by FEMA as compared to previous years. Next, you know, if you can give me a click. So approximately, and these are sort of factoids to give you to understand sort of how we're evolving and how recovery is becoming sort of an important feature of federal support. So approximately 2/3 of our activations are in support of localities impacted by events other than hurricanes. So absolutely, we're in Florida supporting Hurricane Ian. There was that Hurricane Ida in Louisiana. I'm looking at Typhoon Mawar in Guam. I'm sure we'll be activated for that. But many of our recovery missions are really related to sort of those direct line winds, to winter events, to wildfires across the nation. You can give me another click. So this is sort of interesting too for those of you that sort of have experienced the federal support from the ESF 8, the public health and medical perspective, and the DMATs and the sort of the kind of thing that ASPR can do. About half or more than half of our activations did not have a significant support by HHS on the response side. So what does that mean? That means that the jurisdiction was able to sort of experience a tornado, experience a hurricane, experience a wildfire. They were able to manage that response by themselves. Perhaps they received support from contiguous states or tribes or territories, but they managed that at a local level. They did not receive significant ESF 8 support, but they did need help in recovery. I'll give you another click. And most of the missions, and this is sort of where we get to some of that equity piece, most of our missions support localities with really that high score, that high index in the city social vulnerability index. So these are communities that are especially vulnerable to experiencing significant and long-term disaster cost or disaster exacerbated impacts. Give me one more click. So it's really sort of our work is important because we are there to support these communities. Everybody in a community impacted by a hurricane, by a wildfire, by a straight line storm, a tornado, everybody's impacted in the community. But it's those individuals within the community that were especially vulnerable. Those folks, especially that might be in the Empower Map, LGBTQ plus communities, the children and the elderly, those individuals and communities that are especially vulnerable are going to be especially impacted by the disaster, and we're going to be there to support them. Next slide, please. So we have what we call five core mission areas that we support with. So that's behavioral health, education, healthcare, human services, and public health / environmental health. And we strongly believe that there's these four cross-cutting principles across each of these five core mission areas. So that's an integration of older adults and individuals with access and functional needs, the needs of children, youth, climate resilience, and equity. Our doctrinal approach within our recovery support function is we see ASPR and my division, we see ourselves as really high-level coordinators. What we want to bring in, let's say that there's a healthcare system impact, right? We don't want to duplicate if a state jurisdiction has a connectivity tissue to an HPP grant, a state connectivity tissue to a CMS authority, we don't want to duplicate that in the field. We want to invite those subject matter experts to bring, we're going to use that FEMA funds that we get through activation. We want to bring those subject matter experts to the field and have them, yes, you know, there's always a chain of command in the field when you have a response effort, recovery effort, but we also want them to have that strong line of connection to their home office, because we want to be there as quickly as possible, establish that direct line of connection after a disaster, if you will. There's a loss of connectivity to get that technical assistance at the federal level. We want to reestablish that and really move out of the way to support the quick reestablishment of that technical assistance that usually happens on a blue sky. Next slide, please. So, it's sort of, simple, reductive here, but it's really what we want to do. We want to come in, we want to bring in the right subject matter experts. We want to identify what are the areas of interest. We don't want to bring in the subject matter experts to a locality, a jurisdiction that is not of interest to them. So even if there is issues, if, out of 15 issues, if they want support in five of them, we want to identify the federal subject matter experts and help bring them to the field for those small, quick interactions, do that assessment, develop those courses of action, and transition to that steady state support. Next slide, please. And so this is another one of them, click action. And so this is going to demonstrate the kind of things we can do in the field. So if you can give me a click. So capacity building, I'll just read these through. But as you click, if you want to just do six clicks, I believe we're going to get six explanations. You just go ahead through them. Yeah, so when we're in the field, once we identify issues of interest to the jurisdiction, we can support via capacity building, coalition building. Sometimes the right experts to support a jurisdiction are not federal experts, but rather peer-to-peer. We want to identify other states and localities that are doing things extremely well, bring them to the fore, make that connection, step out. We can always bring subject matter expertise and technical assistance as well as skill and training. So come in, assess interventions, and step out for the steady state. Next slide, please. So that's my name. If you want us to, I'm of course happy to answer any questions you might have, but at some point, if you find yourself, your jurisdiction is impacted by a significant event, it's likely, honestly, that we're going to be activated and be there to support you. The typical recovery mission lasts 3 to 6, sometimes 9 months. So we're there. We might bring in, if there's a significant HPP issue or a significant ASPR issue or an issue of your interest, we might bring in the federal expert to speak to the coalitions and others to get them to get that quick technical assistance. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commander Garza. And if, again, if anyone has any questions, just a reminder that you can certainly enter that into the chat, or you can raise your hand and you are welcome to ask your question live. Just a quick question for you, Commander. Could you tell us what is the trigger that initiates support by your office? I know you've mentioned
right. You
know, that they're supported by FEMA funding, but what is it that what is the trigger or are the triggers that would initiate that support that would move your office into beginning to provide that technical assistance and or be on ground?
Absolutely, yeah. The trigger is really that signal from the sovereign leadership at the tribe, state, or territory. So usually, you know, we have a presidentially declared disaster. That's going to, you know, and that only comes from at the request of the sovereign leader to the president. The president declares a disaster. There's a response effort. If post-response, there's significant equities that require support from the health and social services across those five core mission areas, that signal for recovery support would be bring us to the field.
And are you able to provide, in the absence of that, are you able to provide virtual support or technical assistance?
Absolutely. We're fortunate to have some field staff across, you know, the HHS, the 10 regions, what we call the 10 regions in HHS. We see ourselves again as a coordinator role. So if we were, for example, to sort of an HPP perspective, we were in the field either on a mission or just in a sort of regular meeting, right, steady state meeting with some regional partners. If we heard of an HPP sort of situation and somebody from your office wasn't on the call, our role really would be to make that connection, right? We don't want to speak for you. We want to support that steady state relationship you have with them and be that sort of single service window.
Great, thank you. I don't want to hog all the time for folks for questions. So again, if anyone has a question, please enter it into the chat or raise your hand so that you can ask the question live. So I'm not seeing any questions right now, but certainly want to thank you, Commander Garza, for taking the time to share this very important information that your office is doing. And we look forward to, continue our partnership and continue to engage your office. I envy you a little bit about the Blue Angels. One of my favorites.
I'll send you some photos.
As well. Yes, please take photos. But again, yes. Just thank you so much. So I will now pass it over to our final presenter, Joseph McKinnon, to discuss how HHS is addressing the climate change and advancing health equity. So Joseph.
Thank you, Jennifer. And I'm just going to share my screen here. Hopefully this works and everybody can see my screen. Please let me know if you can't. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here with you all today. I appreciate the chance to speak with you in part because I'm looking forward to hearing your questions and your feedback. And in part because I've got some exciting information to share that I think might be quite relevant and timely for many of your organizations. So I want to make sure that I get to that and really talk about the work that our office is doing currently. But before I do that, I do just want to kind of set the scene a little bit on why we're here, both I think why we're here having this conversation today and why we are here as an Office of Climate Change and Health Equity, a new entity within HHS. And, you know, the answer to that question is not one I think I really need to belabor with this audience, but it's just simply the fact that climate change is an urgent crisis, the greatest threat to global public health, according to a consensus statement of more than 200 medical journals in the fall of 2021. And that manifests itself through a whole variety of catastrophic events, highly intense storms and hurricanes. That's a photo of Ian in the top left there. wildfires, flood, that's flood in Kentucky last year, extreme heat, all of these catastrophic events, plus chronic events and chronic disease exacerbation. So I'm talking about cardiovascular disease. I'm talking about asthma and pulmonary disease. I'm talking about vector-borne illness, waterborne illness, mental health issues. Climate change is an exacerbator and a creator of so many problems with such far-reaching impacts. And on top of that, for the health sector, it has major impacts on infrastructure. And you know, this is just data on the billion-dollar disasters in the country in the last 40 plus years. And you know, we can see the increase and what this means for healthcare facilities, of course, is disruptions in operations, major costs, major delays in providing the types of care that they want to provide. So that's all kind of at the heart of why we're here as an office. In addition, though, we're here because just like every other public health crisis in this country, there are certain vulnerable populations for reasons of long-time discrimination, underinvestment, disenfranchisement. There are certain groups and communities that are at a distinct disadvantage and will be disproportionately harmed. And that's certainly true when it comes to climate change. We know that there are certain groups that are in geographic locations where they're going to be at a disadvantage, groups that have pre-existing infrastructure challenges, health issues, all of these things that are going to put them at a disadvantage. On top of the fact that they're dealing with ongoing forms of discrimination in their communities. And so this all is kind of the backdrop against which our office is formed. It's not to say, of course, that there hasn't been lots of critical work going on related to climate change at the Department of Health and Human Services over the last few decades. So the NIH and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences has done important research. The CDC, through the Climate and Health Program, has done important work on the local and regional level. And of course, ASPR has led the medical response to a number of crises that are climate related. So, you know, there's certainly has been significant effort within HHS, but what the Biden administration did in creating our office in January of 2021 is it said that there should be a purpose-built entity within the Department of Health and Human Services to help this entire vast organization to both understand the threats associated with climate change to the health of the people that we serve and understand potential responses and to really make sure that every operating division within HHS, whether it's CDC, CMS, FDA, NIH, HRSA, SAMHSA, ACF, ASPR, making sure that everyone is together as ready as possible for the changes that are coming as a result of climate change. Our office was called for in January of 2021 through this executive order, 14008, Tackling the Climate Crisis at Home and Abroad. It was established in August of 2021, so we're approaching our second birthday here. And we're situated within the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health, Admiral Rachel Levine, who's a great proponent of this work and has been a great supporter of our work as we get set up. We have a very bold vision as an office, which is that in the next 5 to 7 years, what we hope to do is make sure that communities and the healthcare organizations that serve them are transformed such that every community and care provider in every geography is prepared for disruptive and chronic climate impacts in its most vulnerable populations, such that healthcare institutions, like the organizations that many of you represent, are prepared for long-term operation in the face of catastrophe so that there aren't disruptions in operations of the kind that we see too often in the face of intense storms and other crises. And such that every hospital and health system in the United States is acknowledging its own contribution to climate change and is actually tackling reduction of emissions and specifically scope one emissions. These are direct on-site emissions, scope two emissions associated with purchased energy purchased from the grid, And scope three emissions, emissions associated with the supply chain, which is where the majority of emissions are for the health sector. So, you know, we know that the U.S. health sector is responsible for 8.5% of all carbon emissions in the country. And so it needs to stand up and lead on taking action there. So our job, again, is to get all HHS operating divisions galvanized to take action to address this. How do we do that? It's a very tall order. We're a very small office. And the short answer is we do it through others. So we work through partners and other organizations that have more leverage than we do to be able to take more effective action. We start with communities, the communities at greatest risk, to understand their gaps and challenges, not unlike the exercises that Commander Garza was describing, really understanding local challenges and risks, using that to inform our agenda. And then we work, if we go clockwise, with other government agencies, like EPA, like NOAA, like the Department of Energy, to make sure that we are leveraging their programs, that we're collaborating with one another, that they understand the health impacts of new programs that they're introducing. We work with federal health systems. So we have a learning network of federal health systems, including the Veterans Health Administration, the Indian Health Service, the Defense Health Agency. And we come together to work on decarbonization and resilience together. We work also with other nations' health systems. So we have an exchange going on right now with the National Health Service in England to try to align our procurement standards as much as possible to simplify that for suppliers, to simplify our expectations around emissions reduction so that that work will be more straightforward and they're likelier to engage on it. We work with the private sector through something called the National Academy of Medicine Climate Collaborative. This is a collection of private sector leaders, large corporate entities, pharmaceutical companies, suppliers, large associations, and government entities all coming together to set common goals and identify barriers to address together. And then above all, we work again through HHS operating divisions, through the major operating divisions to make sure that they're introducing programs and make sure that they're integrating climate considerations into all their existing programming as well. The way we've started that work within HHS is by through aim setting and making clear commitments to what we want to accomplish as a department. That started with Admiral Levine pictured here at the United Nations Climate Conference in 2021, committing the Department of Health and Human Services to developing a low carbon and resilient health system. And this was an important statement and 50 other countries joined the US in making that commitment. A few months later, the HHS for the first time had introduced a specific strategy, a specific aim in its overall strategy focused on addressing environmental factors and climate change specifically. And then shortly after that, the administration introduced Executive Order 14057, which requires all federal facilities, including federal health systems, to reduce their emissions roughly 50% by between 2030 and 2032, and to get to net zero by 2050. So that was an ambitious set of statements. But as soon as we made those statements, of course, we realized that we very urgently need to make sure that we're engaging the private sector as well. And so we launched something called the White House HHS Health Sector Climate Pledge, which invited private sector organizations to match the commitments of federal health systems and to match the Biden administration's commitments to both resilience and decarbonization. So the organizations that have signed that pledge have committed to reducing emissions 50% by 2030 and getting to net zero by 2050. They've committed to executive leadership on climate resilience and emissions reduction and to conducting inventories of their scope three or supply chain oriented emissions. And they've committed to develop climate resilience plans that focus specifically on the needs of vulnerable populations. So this is a voluntary initiative, but it's already engaged over 115 organizations across the country, representing over 850 private sector hospitals, representing 20 academic medical centers. If you combine the commitments of government facilities and these private sector facilities, that's about 15% of all the facilities in the country that have signed on. So we're sort of approaching a tipping point. Seven Fortune 500 organizations that represent suppliers, pharmaceutical companies, insurers, It's really been a terrific and exciting response. That being said, you know, we realize that you can't stop there with commitments, because commitments are just that, they're just words. We need to actually support the sector in doing this transformative work required to become more resilient and to make investments in emissions reduction as well. So we introduced last summer a compendium of federal resources, basically a scan of all the federal resources that are available for the health sector to tap into to work on addressing climate change. We launched something called the Climate and Health Outlook. This is a monthly outlook that basically forecasts the major climate-related threats to health in the country every month. And you know, we're hoping that facilities and frontline providers will use it increasingly to address challenges, anticipate challenges. It also includes federal resources that can be used to ameliorate those challenges. And then we have something called the Sustainable and Climate Resilient Healthcare Facilities Toolkit. And this is a toolkit that already exists and is currently being updated that really focuses on helping organizations understand climate-related exposures and then develop plans for action that are reactive. And we're aligning this as much as possible with ASPR products like RISC 2.0. So it's all great. There's a lot of resource that's there already, a lot of wonderful tools, not just from HHS, but from other agencies like FEMA and DOE and EPA and many others. So, you know, there's a lot to go on, and we had some good momentum going last summer. And then the Inflation Reduction Act was signed. And our view really is that the Inflation Reduction Act, great as all these existing resources are, the Inflation Reduction Act is going to dwarf them in terms of its impact and its importance and the opportunities that it creates. It's this unprecedented legislation. And for many of us in healthcare, you know, we focused initially on the parts related to Medicare Part D and expanding Affordable Care Act subsidies. But the vast majority of dollars in this legislation are focused on addressing climate change. It's the largest, most historic piece of climate change legislation, certainly in the history of this country. And what it offers is a series of tax credits and grants and loans and technical assistance programs that will allow all types of organizations to take action to address climate change. And so what we've done is we launched over the Earth Day week, we launched something called the Health Sector Resources Hub. And it collects a lot of information, that compendium that I already mentioned to you, a webinar series that introduces tools and resources that I'll say more about in a moment. A great resource, a referral guide for those who are at the front lines of care for the federal resources that they can use to help patients and families, particularly in the summer season with threats of extreme heat. You know, so there are resources for subsidizing energy and accessing government supports that we hope you'll share and that providers will tap into. But the real anchor of what we introduced is something called the Quick Finder for leveraging the IRA for the health sector. It's basically a digest of all the opportunities that are available to take action that are facilitated by the Inflation Reduction Act. And you can use the QR code here to get that, but equally, you know, it's accessible at a link that we're going to drop in the chat. And it gives background on climate change and health equity and the relationship of the two, but it really centers on the investments and actions that are facilitated by the IRA, particularly tax incentives and grants. And it actually names the IRA programs that are relevant. So it goes from, you know, hundreds of options, if you were to read the full legislation, you know, down to somewhere on the order of 15 to 20 that we think are going to be really relevant to healthcare organizations. And it gives case examples, and we'll be adding to those case examples as well of how those funds can actually be used. And these are some of the types of investments that can be made: investments in on-site renewable energy generation, energy efficient building improvements, transportation that is more efficient and sustainable, building resilience and community resilience, so major dollars there, and then funds to decarbonize the supply chain as well. So there's lots and lots available here. And, you know, what we want to encourage you all to do is to take advantage of our webinar series, which has already begun, but every session is recorded and you can get that at this resource hub that'll be dropped in the chat. These sessions really kind of walk through in some detail with each of our partner agencies, the specific opportunities. So, for example, in a few weeks, we have a session with EPA on their decarbonization opportunities. There's a really important session, I think, on June 22nd with Treasury to talk about the tax incentives and tax credits that are available. So we strongly encourage organizations to tune in and tap in to those resources. So I'm going to wrap up there. I'll just do so by saying I think there are lots of potential areas for collaboration and areas where we'd like to collaborate with many of you. I'll particularly point out for state hospital associations or other regional groups that might be on the line, we have done sessions with hospital associations to introduce our office, but also introduce specifically the pledge opportunity and these resources. And those have been quite successful. We did one recently with the Connecticut Hospital Association. It led to organizations signing onto the pledge and being able to kind of tap into this community of learning around all of these federal resources, the Inflation Reduction Act resources, all of these tools and supports. So if you'd like to do something like that, I'm going to put my email address in the chat and we can certainly do something at a regional level for your constituents to help them take advantage of these great resources and supports. We're also always on the lookout for case examples. So if you have some that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear how you've been working on resilience and facility hardening, or how you've been working on sustainability. And equally, we'd love to hear, you know, data you have on cost savings associated with the work. We know that there's been great efficiency that's been achieved through building sustainability projects, for instance. And, you know, that's the kind of data that's great for us to be able to share as well. At the end of the day, we don't succeed if we don't help organizations go from being aware of these opportunities through the IRA to actually applying successfully and implementing the work. So we're willing to help on the mechanics of that application process as well, you know, in a general ecumenical way, so that organizations can tap into these opportunities. So, you know, I'll just finish where I started and say thank you for the opportunity to be with you, and really would be delighted if you would like to tap into some of these resources and opportunities. So thank you.
No, thank you, Joe. Really appreciate the great presentation, and certainly don't want to miss out on anyone being able to ask you any questions. So if anyone has a question, please feel free to drop it in the chat, or please raise your hand and you can ask your question live. I started writing down questions, Joe, and then you answered all of the questions that I had. So great presentation.
I'm just going to drop my email into the chat. And if you want to, you know, again, apply for our listserv or sign up for our listserv or any of our supports that I mentioned, or be in touch, please do reach out and take advantage of those things.
No, thank you for that as well. I'm not seeing any questions in the hang on a sec. That's your email address. I was about to say somebody just popped in, but I don't see any questions and I don't see any hands raised. I know that we're very close to the top of the hour. Also, if anyone has any general questions, this is your opportunity to be asked to ask any of those. Let's see here. I have a question that just came in regarding, are there any updates on the hospital association? Hang on a sec. End of year report and camp access. So I know that our, that was a question directly to me, but I'll answer it for everyone. Folks are asking about the Hospital Association Cooperative Agreement end of year report and camp access. I know that our evaluation team is working on that, and we will be announcing some dates related to the Hospital Association end of year report and camp access. We will certainly document this question and we'll follow up. Two questions here regarding any potential impacts for the for the for for HPP, that's the Hospital Preparedness Program Cooperative Agreement. If an agreement is not reached regarding the debt ceiling, I'll answer that one first. Regarding that, ASPR would announce or provide notification if there are any specific impacts related to the debt ceiling issue regarding the reaching an agreement. And then the second question was, when should we expect our final BP5 budgets? We're hoping to get those out to you as soon as possible, and definitely before the awards are announced. Any other questions? I know we're a minute over. Okay, oops, hang on a sec. Can you confirm the semi-annual financial report? Hang on a sec, sorry. Was no longer required after October 2021. There were filings in the PMS for it. Kathy, let me follow up with ASPR grants management. I believe that it is no longer required, but I do want to get a response from them. But we will certainly follow up. But it's my understanding that it is no longer required. But we will certainly follow up. Again, I just want to take a very brief moment to thank our phenomenal speakers today. I think with any one of them, we certainly could have filled an entire hour with them. So you just got really kind of a quick preview of really the tremendous work that all of them are doing. So thanks to Joe, Kristen, and to Roberto. Really appreciate you taking time out of your day to be with us to present and to respond to questions. And just so you know, all three of these folks have provided their information. So if you have any specific questions, please feel free to reach out to them. And I'm certain that they will connect you with any resources and be able to respond to any questions that you might have. But in addition to thanking our presenters, I want to thank everyone for joining today's call, for listening intently, and then also to our speakers being able to answer my questions that I had. And hopefully those were some of the same questions that some of you may have had. As a reminder for everyone, we always invite you to share your stories regarding how you are using ASPR funding to make a positive impact on your communities. If you have a story to share, please fill out our stories from the field submission form or reach out to your field project officer or your project officer in some instances where you may not have a field project officer. And a member of our team will drop the story from the field submission form link in the chat for easy reference. We look forward to hearing about the great work that you are doing. We know you are doing great work. And on that note, thank you for everything you are doing. We know that you are working very, very hard every day. And I'm sure not only do we thank you, but certainly I think that the nation who is on the receiving end or the end users of the work that you are doing, thank you as well. With that, I think we're going to end today's meeting. And I want to just wish everyone and hope that you have a great day. So thanks again for joining.